It's time for another episode of the Culturaholics, episode 91. We visit with Iron Mom Mehdi Harrison in the second and third block here of the Cultural Hall. Joining me, Richie T, is DJ Rob.
Hello.
As we begin the countdown of, 6 weeks? Seven weeks?
6 weeks, 7 weeks. Oh, to my wedding?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I bide my time. I'm just, trying to get all the wedding plans done before then. We still got to do invitations, engagement photos.
Are you going to get registered?
No.
No, you're not going to register anywhere?
We're just going to let people pay us, with cash.
Really?
Yeah.
You're really not going to get registered anywhere?
Why would we? Because we've already got all the stuff we need.
All of it?
Pretty much.
All of it?
Unless you want to get me a camping chair.
I could give you, but how am I going to know that you need a camping chair unless you tell me on some registry?
You know what? I don't know. We weren't planning on doing a registry.
Here, let me talk you into a registry.
Why?
Here is why. Because people don't know what to get.
Well, and then you tell them to give me cash.
No, but that seems, here we go. Rob, I don't know what to give you.
Cash.
I feel like that's insensitive.
Why?
Because I feel like it's, to me personally, I think that cash is like a gift card where you go, hey, I didn't really want to spend any time on your gift. So I'm going to give you cash.
Oh, okay.
Right? But here's what I think you do. Taking the advice of the married person who knows more.
Right, of course.
Who doesn't really more.
Of course,
more,
yes.
Because that's how that goes.
Okay.
You get registered someplace that has a lot of stuff that maybe you don't need anything right now, but that you like that store.
Okay.
Right? So maybe that's your Target, right? Practical store. Maybe you don't like Target.
Yeah, Larissa, the wife. Loves Target.
Right. So she loves Target, likes to shop there, right?
Yes.
So you do a registry at Target. Even if you don't keep any of the stuff, then you have this massive gift card, and people feel like they got you stuff that you wanted.
Okay.
And then you can go and go back and use it. Because here's the problem. It really is one of those things where it's like, I don't want to be boring and just give them cash. That's lame.
Yeah.
Plus, somebody might sneak into the wedding and steal the envelopes of cash, like what happened down in Carbon County. Then you're out money.
Yeah. Did we talk about that on Articles of News?
That was on this last week's Articles of News.
Yeah. I remember that story.
So to me, if I may, the older, more experienced,
of course.
Passing on the light.
Yeah. No, it's just a friend that doesn't want to give me cash.
No, I think that you'll find that attitude with a lot of people.
Okay.
Well, do you not think so?
Well, why don't I post that on Facebook to all my friends that are coming, I guess.
If they come.
If they're
not going to the BYU-Utah football game.
I know. I'm trying to split loyalties here.
No, but for those people, right? And because it goes, so then it's like this. All right, Rob, I want you to come to my wedding. Let's say I'm getting married again.
Yeah.
All right? I want you to come to my wedding. Here is a gift I want you to buy. All right.
But I'll be DJing your wedding, so that's your gift.
So that's your gift. Okay. Say you weren't DJing my wedding. But so here's the deal. Is it's like, well, how much do you give me in cash?
I'll probably 40 bucks.
Okay. Would you give me 40 bucks though?
Yeah.
Or would it be easier if I went to your registry or if you went to my registry and went, you know what he needs?
I could get him 40 bucks or I could buy him this really cheap camping chair.
Right. I know he wants a camping chair. Or the camping chair is $35. You go, I know he wants this.
All right. Well, I'll talk to her about it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Sure. Sounds good.
Here's why I bring it up.
Yes.
Yesterday, I had my brother, the brother that you know,
yes,
over to the house.
Yes.
With his new girlfriend that I never met.
Yes.
Recent divorcee.
Yes.
And
you met her online.
Yeah.
Was it through an LDS site?
It was.
Wow.
So there that works. Keep trying, everybody.
Yeah, keep trying. There's hope. I was on multiple sites for a couple of years.
And that went?
Nowhere.
Exactly.
I met a real person. Sorry.
We did it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
With love and romance. So what I did is I asked my brother to come over for dinner.
Okay.
Right? And he said, hey, can I bring anything?
Yes, your girlfriend.
Right? Which, we kind of joked around about. I mean, like, make sure you bring your girlfriend, because that's why I'm inviting you over, so I can meet her. Haven't met her yet. They've been going out for 6 months or so.
Uh-huh.
But I said to him, I want you to bring fruit salsa. He said, can I bring anything? I said, bring fruit salsa.
Fruit salsa, there's like one, mango.
He said, do you mean mango salsa? Yes. And I said, no. There is a salsa that you can make where it's just various like processed fruits, right?
Oh.
You just chop them up. It's like apples and pears and kiwis and mango and orange and all this stuff. And then you do cinnamon sugar tortilla chip, right?
So you're like telling him to make something very, very, very specific.
Right.
Why didn't you make it?
And, well, but here was the deal. He said, is there anything that you want me to bring?
Right. And now you're answering.
And so I said,
uh-huh.
Yes, there is. I'd like you to bring fruit salsa.
Right.
My wife said, why would you ask something so specific?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
To which I said to my brother, did it bother you that I asked you specifically? He said, no, because then I knew what you wanted.
Okay. It's like at the grocery store when they say, do you need it? Did you find everything you needed today?
Right.
And then, because it's just a pleasantry at that point.
Right. Rob, I know you're going through a hard time right now. Call me if I can do anything for you.
Actually, Richie, I need you. I need somebody to come over and mow my lawn.
Okay, I can come over and mow your lawn.
You're like, whoa, wait. I wasn't asking. I was just saying that as a
social grace. But that's the thing to me. And so I say that to people. I say, please don't say that to me unless you
really mean it.
Unless you really intend.
So if you take anything away from this podcast today, know that when somebody asks you something like that, be very specific in your needs.
Or don't say it.
Okay.
Can I do anything for you? Yeah, I want you to do this. Oh, I wasn't really wanting to do that. Then you shouldn't have said it.
All right.
Get a registry at Target. Coming up in the second and third block, it's Iron Mom, Mehdi Harrison. It's the Cultural Hall.
Hi, this is Lindsay with Sunstone and Sunstone Magazine. I am here to tell you about the exciting new things happening at Sunstone. For 38 years, Sunstone has been the platform for open and frank explorations of Mormonism, both past and present. Much of the scholarship that you and I both benefit from online and in our lived Mormonism has made us stop at one time or another at Sunstone. Every year, Sunstone provides lovers of Mormonism with a gathering place to discuss a wide variety of topics at the Sunstone Symposium. It is coming up super fast and will be held at the University of Utah from July 31st to August 3rd, 2013. You guys, this year is going to be amazing. You don't want to miss it. We have the organizers of the Wear Pants to Church Day event, where they'll be discussing the event and also showing off the pants quilt, which is a quilt made from the pants that people wore on that historic day that the Smithsonian has expressed interest in displaying. There will be workshops on Mormon passive aggression, a panel of real-life 40-year-old virgins. There's going to be tons of panel discussions on scholarship and polygamy. If you've gone through a faith crisis, there are several different choices to choose from to deal with that, whether it be you and your spouse or different places with your faith, or you just don't know how to navigate a faith crisis, or, you know, you did and now you believe, or you did and now you don't believe. All kinds of things. There's going to be panels on the scriptures, looking at the scriptures from one point of view or another. There will be all sorts of Mormons and restorationists there, members of the Community of Christ, the former RLDS, even polygamists. They all come together at this time to get together and discuss Mormonism. It's super awesome. Famed historian Michael Quinn and other notable names in Mormon history and scholarship attend almost every year, and they'll be here this year, and you get to mingle with them. It is so fun. There is also going to be a banquet this year that will feature four hilarious roadshows from the Feminist Mormon Housewives, Writers at Times and Seasons, and the Young Mormon Feminists at BYU. There will also be a steak dance for you and your family. Guys, it's Mormon culture at its finest without having to answer the temple recommend questions. It's like getting dessert and then more dessert and not having to worry about watching your weight. It's awesome. Don't miss the biggest Mormon party of the year. Register now at sunstonemagazine.com and stay tuned for more exciting changes this year at Sunstone. We'll see you there and enjoy your podcast.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Time for the second block of the Cultural Hall, and here joining me is, I don't want to say Superwoman because that might, let's just say Superwoman. Let's go with that. It's Mehdi Harrison, who is going to talk about, among other things, her book Iron Mom. But I want to start here. Before the microphones got turned on, you were talking about taking your son or daughter to the MTC.
My oldest is a girl, my daughter.
Okay. So she's one of the ones that's getting the benefit of the younger mission age.
Yeah, she's just turned 19.
Where is she going to serve?
Texas.
Okay. Spanish? English?
No, English.
Okay. So how has it been as a mom preparing for a 19-year-old daughter to leave?
Well, I mean, I guess we all learn different things from different experiences. She's been off at college for a year at MIT.
Oh, geez.
And we didn't have a lot of contact with her. Honestly, she was so busy studying that if we got a brief phone call every couple of weeks, that was as much as we heard from her. So I think a mission is not going to be too much different than that.
Right.
It was interesting for me because when it came down to buying the mission clothes, I sat down and I was going to get it all done because that's what I do. I, you know, make lists and I'm like, okay, here we go. Let's make a list of the stores we're going to and the clothes we need to buy at each store. And she said, Mom, I'm a grown-up. I don't need my mom to help me buy clothes. And I sat down and felt a little bit sad and useless. I said, do you want me to pay for them? And she said, no, Mom. And she kind of rolled her eyes. I've been saving my whole life for this. So I was like, oh, so you don't really need me to do anything? No. Okay. So I just sat back and let her do it all on her own.
And pretty hard, it sounds like.
It was a little hard. I mean, I am a parent who believes very much in independence and teaching independence to your kids and stepping back.
Until it backlashes and then you go, wait a minute.
No, I still believe in it. It just was a little painful, yeah.
And she was able to get it all done by herself?
Totally. The night before, we sat there watching her pack up her suitcases and laughing a little because she's uber prepared. She really had everything that we could possibly imagine. She had extra blankets in there and she
extra
had
blankets. She's going to Texas.
I know, but she, just in case, you never know.
It's on the list.
Yeah, it was on everything on the list. And we had a long conversation about every single rule in the handbook and whether or not it was serious that you had to step out of the car if your companion was backing up, and if you had to exactly help your companion back out in every situation, or whether she should talk to the mission president about some situations that she had thought up where maybe it would be safer to stay in the car rather than be behind the companion like on a busy freeway. So, yeah, that was fun.
But good that she talked through it because, yeah, you don't want to back up. You don't want to get out of the car and back up on the freeway. That's awesome. That's
right.
Great. Are you one that can take a certain amount of pride in the fact that she's so independent? Can
oh,
you
yes.
kind of step back and
definitely.
Be like, yeah, way to go.
Yeah, I feel like I did a good job as a parent, really, that even though there was that little moment of pain, maybe more than a moment, but still, I was like, this is really a sign that I've done the right thing as a parent, and she's ready.
She one who's always wanted to go on a mission?
No. With all of the kids, we had them save money from when they were little. We had a little special piggy bank where they could put money in for mission, tithing, spending, and saving.
Yeah. Like the
and
little four.
Yeah.
The little, I've seen those. Those are great.
Yeah,
the
we used
four
those
slots. Yeah.
With the little kids, and then when it was filled up, we take it to the bank. So she'd been saving for a long time, but we did tell our girls that if they decided not to go on a mission, that they
that
could use the money.
The money?
No, we told them they could choose someone else who was going on a mission that they could give the money to.
Oh, wow.
So she wasn't necessarily deciding when she was really young to go. It was only really when the announcement was made, because she had been planning probably to stay at MIT for 4 years and finish her degree before she would think about a mission. But when that change happened, she spent a good 4 or 5 months deciding whether she wanted to go and then getting paperwork
like,
in. Once
I'm
she
out.
Decided, then it was the list of things that we had to get done, her wisdom teeth out, and which we did over Christmas vacation.
Which is the worst time to do it, because then you can't eat. That's the thing that Christmas vacation is about.
It was really fun. We went up to Lava Hot Springs for our family vacation, mm-hmm. and which meant we were going out to eat for every meal. Mm-hmm. And she just had the teeth out, and her face was so swollen. And every restaurant she went to, she would ask the waitress, like, if she'd order something and say, will it fit in here? And she'd open her mouth a tiny little bit. Like, she'd try to order little tiny hamburgers. Will they fit in here? Yeah. It was really fun. She was a good sport.
She sounds quite a bit like you, though, from what I've gathered from the little bit of research that I do before each of these, is someone that once they've made their mind up, they just do it. And that seems like something that, from the stuff that I've read about you, that it's like, yeah, okay, I'm going to do this thing. Specifically with the book that you've written, Iron Mom. But let's get to know you a little bit. Are you a convert to the church or a lifer?
No, I'm a lifer. I grew up in New Jersey. I'm from a very large family, 11 children. We were very growing up in New Jersey, got asked a lot of weird questions when I was a kid. People thought that I was my brother's identical twin because my mother would cut my hair really short because it took less time to take care of.
Sure.
So all the girls had really short hair. But grew up there until I was about 10, and then my parents moved us back to Provo. My dad wanted to teach at BYU. That had been his lifelong dream.
What did he teach?
So he taught computer science. Okay. And he's probably really well known if anybody took classes from Evan Ivey back in the day.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are your folks converts, or where does it go?
No, boy, I don't know how far back it goes. Boy, pioneers.
Yeah, pioneer stock.
I'm actually named after, Mette is a good Danish name, and I'm named after a grandmother who converted to the church in the very early days, 1800s, and came and settled in Utah.
Okay.
She was rejected by her family, and anyway, that's where the name Mette comes from. But my mother's name is Betty, so that's where the influence of Mette pronunciation comes
daughter
from.
Daughter of Betty. So, yeah. Although it's Mette for all intents and purposes. Yeah. But you, so you came here to Utah, age 10. Dad teaches at BYU, so then a Utah County kind of upbringing?
Yeah. I lived in Provo area, went to Timpview High School, met my husband there. We actually met on the swim team. Yeah, we swam in the same lane.
And one time I purposely swam in front of him, and then, you know, love at first lane, first freestyle.
No, we would do torturous things to each other, like send each other puzzles that nobody could possibly figure out, and then yell at each other in a nice way the next day, like, what do you think I was supposed to do with that puzzle? I couldn't figure that out. But there were ways that we were trying to ask each other out in some clever fashion. It was
looking back, you're like, why didn't I just ask him out, or why didn't he just ask me out?
I don't know. I don't regret it. I think it was fun. We had a good time.
Did he husband serve a mission?
He went to Haiti.
So you waited for him?
I wouldn't put it that way. He, when he left, made it really clear that he wasn't expecting me to wait for him. And I didn't think it was necessarily a great idea to spend 2 years of college, my first 2 years of college, mm-hmm. hanging around waiting. So I actually dated a number of other people, most of them, strangely enough, named Matt H., just like my husband. I don't know if that was to annoy my parents, which it did annoy them, if that was just a coincidence, it was funny. My parents were not very happy with me dating seriously in high school. My dad was determined to break us up.
And so you guys were pretty serious then in high school, besides the puzzles and all the flirting and that stuff, you actually...
Well, I think that was part of the seriousness, that, you know, we enjoy each other's intellectual capacities, and so that was fun. And it's still part of our relationship, those sorts of puzzles.
So what... Where did you study while he was gone, your first 2 years of college?
Oh, this is a funny story. So while my husband was gone on his mission, he's a year older than I am. So I just started BYU when he left, and I finished a bachelor's and a master's degree by the time he got back.
So you guys are all really smart, is essentially what I'm getting from daughter and MIT and these intellectual puzzles going back and forth.
There's not just like smart genes there.
It's not
yes.
like, we're kind of smart. It's like... Mind blown. Kind of smart. It's okay. You can own it.
Well, you know, they're smart and then they're smart. Like, I tell people frequently, this is my theory of smart people. For every area in which they're smart, there's another area in which they are equally stupid.
Okay.
I believe that is certainly true of me. My social skills sort of lag behind. you know, it may be partly just inborn. It may be partly that you spend a lot of time doing the things you get more approval for and happy feedback for. And and everybody has limited time. So.
Sure.
And athletics was one of those things that got dropped when I was convinced that I was smart and I wasn't athletic. And I, in high school, spent a lot of time swimming and was really not successful at all. Mm-hmm. In 3 years of high school swimming, I never won a race.
Awesome.
So
that's a great record. It's 100% losing.
Yeah, I was very consistent about that. And I freaked myself out with every, at the beginning of every race, told myself I wasn't going to do a good job, and that inevitably came true. And by the time I was done with high school, I said, I'm not an athlete, I'm done.
Yeah, put the attention elsewhere. So where did you go to college?
So I went to BYU for 2 years, and when I graduated with the master's there.
How were you able to get that done that quick?
Well, I had a lot of AP credit, which helped. Okay. And I lived in Germany. My degree's in German. And I lived in Germany for a year when I was in high school.
So you were able to wave out of a bunch of stuff.
So I spoke German fluently by the time I started and ended up... Like, a lot of missionaries will get credit when they get back to BYU. 2 years of German credit. And I got that because I had essentially the same kind of German experience. Mm-hmm. So that was partly... That helped. And then the AP credit. And then I also took... The first semester I was at BYU, I took 18 credit hours. Jeez. And then if you get good enough grades, this is something you find out, but if you get good enough grades, you can apply to get a waiver to take more credits. Okay. So each semester I would keep applying to take more credits. So one semester I had 30 credit hours.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So as long as I was keeping my scholarship, they were okay with me doing that.
Yeah.
So that was how I did it.
What was your master's in?
In German also.
In German as well.
Yeah, I used to tell people that with Matt gone on a mission, I didn't have much to do with my time, so I would just spend it studying.
Yeah.
I did go on a few dates, but...
No, you dated a lot. You told us. It's
fine. I dated all guys named Matt, but never went anywhere, so it was like one date, and then that was it.
With the hopes of using the German to do what?
I wanted to teach college, and in fact, I did. I went to Princeton after Matt got back in his mission, and I graduated.
Jeez. Is everyone writing this down with us? So we're talking about 2 years for a bachelor's and a master's and then teaching at Princeton.
And I dragged Matt off with me to Princeton. He went to Rutgers, which is the state university nearby. Mm-hmm. And I got a PhD. How many years did it take? It took me about 5 years to finish the PhD there.
Jeez.
And then I actually taught at BYU for 4 years.
Okay.
Before I ended up deciding that. At that point, I had 3 kids under the age of 3.
Oh my gosh!
And I just couldn't do it. So, like, I wasn't really super mom. And in essence, I thought I was super mom. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, my husband and I sat down and had this conversation. And he's like, you know, you're really amazing. You can do twice as much as anybody else. And he's like, so you can be a great mom and you can be a great writer, creative writer. But I don't think you can be a great mom and a great writer and a great professor, all three, because you only have limited time. So I looked at the three and tried to decide which two mattered the most to me. And the
was
two
that hard, though?
It was really painful. Because
I look at that and I have a lot of varied interests. You know, I do a little acting stuff and I do, you know, this whole thing and I do my day job and I've got all this stuff. And for me, it's like, man, what do I want to give up? I don't want to give up any of it. And so I continue to heap it on and try and accomplish it. And then I find that I'm not really doing great at any of it.
Well, I think that realization that you can have certain things as hobbies, but not as careers, I mean, is one of the realities of life that you have to accept. Mm-hmm. But no, like you, I have the same problem that hobbies often start becoming careers. They and you have to push them back.
How do you do that?
I'm not great at it, really. Probably my kids would complain. Like, triathlon was supposed to just be this hobby, and it has taken over my life to a certain degree, and I keep trying to push it back year by year. A couple of years ago, I made a goal to not make any more goals for triathlon, because the more goals that I made, the more time I spent trying to achieve those goals, and it ended up taking away time from my family. So, I mean, there really is a problem of balance.
Sure.
I think everybody has that problem. And every year of your life, you're going to have to make a new choice about how that balance is going to work out. So I wouldn't say I have the perfect balance. I just do my best.
Yeah. 3 kids under the age of 3, that is crazy to me. Was it difficult?
I mean,
obviously, it seems like, yeah, of course, it's a difficult thing. But that just seems like overwhelmingly difficult.
There were hard parts. really one of the more tricky parts about that was that my husband had a home business at the time, and the money was really tight. And so for me not to bring in any more money at a certain point was really stressful in terms of making the budget every month. And, you know, I'll be honest, we made some terrible, terrible decisions. My kids all know about them. We talk about it. We're financially sound now and we have good financial habits, but we lived on a credit card for several years, bought groceries on a credit card because we didn't have any other source of income. And that was really stressful. I do not recommend it to anybody precisely because it added so much stress to our relationship. And just every day, the consciousness that, you know, the food that you were eating wasn't really yours. It was terrible.
You talk about that you made the decision to drop being a college professor and to be a creative writer.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk quite a bit about Iron Mom, which, again, I've teased a couple of times. But you have written just tons of books, right?
I have written tons. I have published 8 books, including Iron Mom. So 7 other fiction titles.
Roll them off for us.
Okay. The Monster in Me was published in 2002.
That was your first one?
That was my first one. And it sounds like it's a paranormal book. It's really contemporary fiction. The funny thing about this story is it's set in Heber, Utah, and it's about a girl whose mother is a drug addict. So she gets taken out of the home and placed with a Mormon foster family in Heber. And she runs. She runs to escape from the problems in her life, to feel kind of clean. The weird thing about the book is that I was not a runner when I wrote it. I was a wannabe runner. I had terrible knee problems for years and years. After I stopped swimming, I tried running for a little bit in college and ended up with a knee injury. Mm-hmm. And the doctor told me to stop running.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, basically. Does that hurt when you do that? Then don't do that. And I listened to him for about 12 years. And so, but I wanted to run. I kept having this imagined running life.
Was it familial? Like someone in your family runs, or you're just like, it's inside of me. I need to get this running spirit.
No, definitely not familial. My family is very intellectual. In the 3 years that I was in on the high school swim team, my parents came to 0 swim meets.
But in fairness, there were 11 of you. So
yes. But they came to every single academic assembly that I ever won an award at. Mm-hmm. Even though I was like, please don't make me go to this stupid assembly. They're like, no, you're going. So it's not that they weren't supportive. It's just, it was very clear to me as a kid growing up what they cared about. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't athletics. Mm-hmm. So
that's the first book.
The Monster in Me. Then Mirror Mirror was my first speculative fiction. It's a fantasy. And it's the story of Snow White told from the point of view of the mirror, who is, in my version, the enchanted sister of the evil queen on a quest to become human again. So the mirror's up on the wall in the queen's castle like 100 years after the queen is dead. And she's trying to figure out a way to get somebody to come into the castle, take her off the wall, and like take her to a place where she can get enough magic to become human again. So that after that was The Princess and the Hound, which has probably been my best-selling book to date. That one is a story about Prince George, who has this animal magic, which means he can hear animals talk and communicate with them, but he can't let anybody know he has it because people who have the animal magic in his kingdom are burned at the stake.
Ooh.
So he has a very lonely growing up life, and he ends up becoming betrothed to this princess from a neighboring kingdom to stop a war between them. And she is known to have this hound that she takes with her everywhere. And at first he thinks maybe she has the animal magic too. Mm-hmm. But when he meets her for the first time, he discovers that this hound is the only animal he's ever met that he can't talk to.
Okay.
So it's a mystery, and there's a bit of romance between Prince George and the princess. And then, of course, the fantasy magic sort of going on. There are sequels to that. The Princess and the Bear and The Princess and the Snowbird are about later characters in the book. Mm-hmm. So each book is contained in and of itself. You could read them all independently. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Triss and Izzy is a retelling of an old German epic. And I have gotten a few readers who complain about the book because the only Tristan and Isolde that they know is the James Franco movie, which is fine. You know, I like the James Franco movie, except it's not Tristan and Isolde. It's Romeo and Juliet set in Ireland because there's no magic in it. The original German epic, which I read when I was in graduate school.
So take that, everyone.
In middle high German.
She's a doctor of German.
has lots of magic in it, and there's a dragon. And so I wrote this version where you have these characters who are contemporary high school students, but they fall into this magical world where there's a dragon and other figures from the German medieval history. So anyway, that was fun. And then The Rose Throne just came out this year.
Okay.
Which
What's
is,
that about?
It's about two princesses from rival kingdoms who meet, and they have to, they're like people who could become friends, but, only one of their kingdoms is going to survive. They're pretty much headed towards this terrible civil war, and only one person is going to rule both kingdoms. So these people who might have been friends are ending up rivals for each other.
So then talk to us a little bit about what Iron Mom is about, and then we'll come back and we'll talk all about it.
Okay. So Iron Mom starts with the story of my first Iron Man competition, which was in 2006. I did Coeur d'Alene, which is in Idaho. It's the closest, it was the closest Iron Man to where I live. So the first draft I wrote of that chapter and sent off to my editor, I mentioned in, one sentence that I signed up for the race 9 days after my sixth child was stillborn. And sent it off to my editor because I didn't want to talk about it. And she sent it back and she said, you can't blow that off in one sentence. Yeah. You really got to talk about it. It's not like I haven't written about it before. I've written about it. It's not always easy to talk about. Sure. So I had to spend some time going back in and weaving through the story of that chapter, what led me to race, and why it was an important event for me, how it helped me grieve that loss. So for me, the reason it was important was that I had a plan. You've already noticed that I'm somebody who has, like,
I've noticed free spirit wandering, aimless, maybe, would be a phrase.
Yeah, so when I set myself a plan, I do the plan, which has good parts and bad parts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm accused of not being very flexible. This is from my children. Yeah, I have some problems with flexibility. But the good thing for me was every morning when I woke up, I could think about the workout for the day, and then when I was finished with the workout for the day, I could do a little check off the list, and it helped me move closer to a future rather than looking back at the past and what I'd lost. I could look forward to something that I had wanted to do, but had always sort of thought, oh, that will be in the far, far future. And being able to do something that I was proud of myself for also really helped me to focus and be a little more positive than I might have been inclined to be naturally. I'm not trying to suggest that this is a solution for all people who are grieving. I had done some triathlons before, so it was, and I had enjoyed them. But also, I'm just the kind of person who needs a goal. Although, you know, I sometimes have too many goals and have to cut back on them. But that was what started it. And then we've just had so many wonderful experiences as a family doing various races, either me doing it and the kids volunteering, or them just cheering for me, or sometimes I've dragged them and made them do races with me. My husband got the Ironman bug in 2010 and did his first Ironman, and we don't do a lot of training together because we have five kids. Sure. And it can be hard to find time where we both aren't scheduled with the kids, so often we train separately, or, you know, we have exercise equipment, we have a treadmill and bike stuff in our house so we can be downstairs. But every once in a while, we'll do a race together where we actually stay together. And that's really fun. It's a really meaningful, positive experience. And in some ways, one of the chapters in the book is about how triathlon saved my marriage. Because after a stillbirth...
Hang on. We'll get into it in just a minute. Kay. In the third block here of the Cultural Hall, we're visiting with Mehdi Harrison, author of the book Iron Mom, among others. That's coming back in the third block.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5500. 7576 to book your shoot today.
This is the third block here of the Cultural Hall, and visiting with Mehdi Harrison, who is the author of the book Iron Mom. I got to ask you this, because it's a lot of fantasy, you know, your other books, right? And mm-hmm. It's a made-up girl in Heber City that, you know, is running away from her problems and all that stuff. We're running to deal with it. How come this book is, I'm assuming, based on what you've told me so far, and we'll keep getting into it, kind of autobiographical? Why the choice to do that?
Well, I know that most people who are not writers themselves have this idea that writers like to write the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. I actually don't know any writers who are like that. Most writers write about everything, mm-hmm. but just don't get everything published. So even though I have a lot of books that are published that are fantasy, mm-hmm. I have dozens of books that are unpublished that
like
are
what?
Of
like different about what?
Well, actually, just this year I sold a series that's called The Bishop's Wife. The first book is called The Bishop's Wife, and it's contemporary mystery for adults about a Mormon bishop's wife who is an amateur sleuth, and she brings this is my spiel for it. She brings hot cookies and hot cinnamon rolls to people's houses, offers to babysit their kids, and then when they're gone, she rummages through their filing cabinets, finds out all their secrets, and solves crimes. So, but I just sold it to a national publisher. I had no idea whether anyone would ever publish it, because it's not really the kind of fiction I thought Deseret Book would be interested in. Uh-huh. It's a little grittier, but it's so Mormon. The weird thing was that I sent it off to an editor who's a friend of mine, and she ended up saying, "We want more Mormon stuff." She's like, I want more. I want a sacrament meeting and like a release society meeting in the book. So there's now added chapters where I put in the character going to various meetings.
You want Relief Society? I'll give you Relief
Society.
Yeah,
I mean, I was like, well, that's easy. That's the easy part, is putting in the Mormon stuff. The mystery was trickier. But I write lots of contemporary fiction for teens. I write romances. I have a series I'm trying to sell that I call marriage romances, about married couples who are falling back in love with each other. Because I feel like a lot of the almost all romances are about people who are meeting for the first time and falling in love. Mm-hmm. But the people that I know who are married know the reality that of marriage is that if you're going to keep a marriage alive in the long term, you're falling in love repeatedly.
Yeah, constantly, it seems.
Maybe not constantly, but I do think there are phases. You go through a phase of several years and you have to figure out how to fall back in love with the person that you... That your spouse has become, and you are a different person yourself. And so, anyway, I mean, there's lots of different projects, and I have some writing books that I've been working on how to write. So I write lots of stuff.
And you have five kids, and you run triathlons.
Yes. My house is very messy. That's one of the chapters in the book. I never clean out my refrigerator, and other confessions of a triathlete. So
it's one of the chapters of your book.
Yes.
You mentioned that your marriage was a little bit rocky, and how the triathlon kind of
I think after we lost our baby, we were both so grief-stricken that it was hard for us to give the support to each other that we really needed.
Just a quick question, and you obviously don't have to answer, but I mean, how far along?
I was 2 weeks overdue.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in every sense of the word, the baby should have been born. We were waiting. Mm. We really don't know what happened. In fact, the doctor told me at the birth that the placenta had just stopped working, which sadly increased my guilt over the whole situation. I felt like it was my fault. And my husband felt like it was his fault, because the night before I'd asked him to take me to the hospital because I felt like something was wrong. And he was like, "Oh, you're crazy. You're just, this is like late pregnancy craziness that I've dealt with five other kids."
And maybe I
was overreacting. It's hard, you know, just because it turned out that there was a problem doesn't mean that, that was a true feeling, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Or that they could have done anything. Even if I had gone in then, the baby could well have been dead already. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You can see sort of his guilt, my guilt, ended up setting us at odds with each other. And for a few years, we had a tough time. I don't know if people looking in could tell, because my husband and I are both very good at...
Everything's fine.
Well, not just saying everything is fine, but we're really good at our lists of getting things done and making sure that the family was still functioning in a good way. But sort of emotionally, there were a lot of problems. And at some point, my husband, who had said to the kids, I will never, ever do an Ironman. I will never, ever do that. That's crazy. He ended up deciding he wanted to do it. And then I got to be his coach, and we got to talk. It just became something that we love to talk about and we love to do together. And we took the kids on vacations with each other. And it was really a place for us to bond instead of, situations where we were tearing each other apart.
Kind of an aside, obviously, but what kind of advice would you give people that are listening to this that go through that similar kind of situation? Because there's got to be, I know there's got to be people listening that have had that same experience and just like it sounds like you did, didn't know how to deal with it.
Well, I guess I'm partly reluctant to tell other people how to figure out how to do it. Maybe the best advice would be to just let yourself grieve in your own way. One of the things that I struggled with was the sense that I had that other people were telling me that it was time to be done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was a while ago. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Let it go.
Shortly after I lost the baby, I was called into the primary, and I really came close to telling the bishop no. In fact, I went in and told the bishop that I was having suicidal thoughts, and I really wasn't sure that being in the primary was a good choice for me after just having lost a baby. For me, it was sometimes very painful to be around children because I would watch and see other children doing things that my daughter would never be able to do.
Right.
Even my own children, it could sometimes be painful that I would feel jealous on her behalf that my other children were able to do things that she would never be able to do. And so I wasn't sure that that was a good choice. The bishop ended up talking me into it. And I spent 3 years in the primary presidency, and I still don't know if that was a good choice. Every day was a struggle. Every Sunday that I went to church was really hard. So
why did you keep doing it then?
I tried to get out of it a couple times. I did try. I went to the bishop and said, again, bishop changed. I went into a new bishop and said, I don't think this is right for me.
There's an old guy that I should do this. I don't want to be here. New guy, huh? What do you think?
Yeah.
Can I get out of this?
And the new bishop ended up saying, okay, we'll release you. But then the primary president called and she talked me back into it. I mean, I'm not saying that she was wrong. Looking back, I'm not sure that it was right or wrong to do one or the other. Mm-hmm. I think the wrong thing was that in my head, I was telling myself that I didn't have a choice, that I had to do this. Mm. And that it was almost as though it were a punishment for having done something wrong. So if I could give advice to anybody, it would just be to try to be as nice to yourself as you would be to somebody else. It's like, I would never have told any other woman who'd been in the situation I was in that it was her fault or that she should punish herself for not having done everything right. But I did that to myself. I just had this super high standard. And in some ways, has helped me in life do a lot of achievements, but in that particular case it was really a millstone around my neck, that it was just this weight every day. I was supposed to be perfect, and I wasn't. It was clear I was not perfect.
It's pretty cultural too, I think, within
the need to be perfect.
Yeah, the need to be perfect.
Yeah, the problem is I think that some people have a tendency to need to be perfect to an extreme that other people do not understand. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our cultural language will encourage that sort of really a kind of mental illness to think that it's good. When I don't think that's ever what's intended.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of your mental illness interpreting things as saying, you always have to be sacrificing. You should never be doing anything for yourself. I don't really think that that's what the church is trying to teach. I think it's, just in your head, but
where we manipulate it to go, oh, of course, this is why I need to be doing this because of the need to be perfect. But I think, I think the call was to be perfect, but Christ made it so you don't have to do it all by yourself. And I think sometimes we remove that.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between going to church and somebody saying, hey, you are being called to repentance. And going home and thinking, I can make my life better. There's a difference between that and going to church and feeling like I will never be good enough. I might as well give up now. Mm-hmm. I was having a tendency to do that. So I don't know if it can be stopped. But if there are people out there listening, I would just say, there are people who love you just as you are, even with your imperfect self, and God's one of them. And maybe also I would say, God can take the anger. Like, you don't have to put it on yourself. You can just say, like, shout at God instead of yourself. Yeah. Like, get mad at him. He's the one who picked it. And I sounds maybe blasphemous, but I really do believe that if God gives you something, I don't believe that if God gives you something, then you can handle it. I don't believe that at all. People would tell me that all the time. I'd be like, that's really not helpful.
You couldn't handle.
No, I don't like that. But I do believe that if God gives you something that's really hard, that he expects you to shout at him and he can handle it. Like, he's all powerful, and you being angry at him is not going to hurt him a bit. So
That's an interesting kind of way of looking at it. So yeah, sorry about that, John, as we kind of go down that. So what I can't get, though, in this whole thing as I'm hearing it, is it seems like these huge insurmountable triathlons, as far as this goes, like, it just seems like such a physical, you know, exhaustion. And with everything else that you have going on, to go ahead and do it. So I guess my question is kind of, you know, you do it this one time, why not one and done? Why not? I did this the one time and now I'm, you know what I'm saying? It's like, time I want to jump out of a plane. Like, that's one for me. I wanted to jump out of a plane. I have no interest in ever jumping out of a plane again, but I did it. I went up one time and went, man, that's something that heights scare me. The plane ride up scared me to death, but I got out there and to be able to look down at the ground and be like, man, this is awesome. This is like flying. And then I never want to do it again.
I suspect that, that most people who do something like that can become addicted to it. Mm-hmm. For me, there's a sort of focus that you get when you're in an extreme sports situation, mm-hmm. like Ironman, that feels good. That's nonsense. Like, you're in pain. Yeah. Yes.
Like, my whole body, I can't move
it
right now.
Yes, your whole body hurts.
This is so pointed.
My husband laughs and some of my friends laugh because I'll often finish a really long race and I'll have lost, I don't know, 6 to 8 toenails having done it. But I have no awareness of having lost them. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that the rest of my body is in so much pain that you can't process smaller pain. Mm-hmm. And the toenails turn out to be smaller pain. But I don't know. It's this hyper focus. And there's a sense of community that you get in triathlon that it's one of the things I talk about in the book. On the second Ironman I did, I ended up with a double flat on the second loop of the bike down in St. George. And I had a tube to fix one flat. Mm-hmm. And I know how to fix my own flats. I practiced lots of times for precisely this situation. But when I got a second flat, I did not have a tube for another flat. Mm-hmm. And so I sat by the side of the road hoping that race support would come and get me and help. But no one came. A guy came by on a four-wheeler, and I thought he was going to help me, but it turns out, no, he had nothing to fix bikes either. Had no idea why he was there at all. Like, what are you?
I was just driving by.
He said it was race support, but I guess he said that if I had been injured, then he would call an ambulance and help me, but he couldn't help me fix my bike. So I sat there for an hour in this race, and, you know, you're counting the time, and I had been so hopeful that I would be able to get a PR. You're always thinking about your best time. And as this hour went, you know, drained away, I realized that wasn't going to happen. I wasn't going to have a PR on this race. But this gentleman, Southern gentleman, still remember, he came and pulled over by the side of the road. And I said, oh, you're not going to be able to help me because I have 650 wheels. Most people ride 700 wheels. I'm very small and ride like a 48 centimeter frame with 650 wheels. So it looks like a little kid's bike. Mm-hmm. People tease me about it sometimes.
That's your daughter's bike.
So I was like, you're not going to be able to help me because I can't use your tubes. And he said, I carry 650 tubes just to help people in case they're on the side of the road. And I was just in such awe that this person carried extra weight on his bike just in case he needed to help somebody else. It was just, this guy wasn't a Mormon. He was just a good person who, he didn't care about his time as much as he cared about helping somebody else at the race. So he stayed with me for like 20 minutes, getting my bike tire pumped back up. And then he helped make sure that I got back on the road safely. And then I took off and left him behind because he was actually, you know, he was quite a bit slower than I was, which is why he came by an hour later. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of the race, it was it was the most amazing experience for me because I realized that I no longer cared about my time. And so the rest of the race could just, I could just go whatever pace I wanted, whatever felt good, mm-hmm. because nobody cared at this point what my finish time was. And I looked at the scenery. I chatted with people as I never had done before. When I got to the run, I ran when I felt like running. I walked when I felt like walking. And I talked to everybody at every aid station. And I realized that this was sort of a part of triathlon that I had missed before. Mm-hmm. This wonderful community of people who are there to help each other along the way. And to me, it was like this microcosm of life, of this life lesson.
I was just
going to
say, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just such a great... But I have that kind of experience every race that I go to. There's another life lesson. And maybe... I'm sure there are life lessons in everything that you do, but there's a heightened awareness, I think, when you are really... struggling physically, that you notice things. I don't know if that's true for everybody, but like people go to girls' camp or to these Aaronic priesthood camps, and they have these difficult struggles where somebody will put like a burden on their back and they'll carry it and they'll have a spiritual experience while they're doing it. I think there is something to this idea that you have spiritual experiences when you are in physical extremes. Hmm. And there's a part of me that seeks that out and finds it wonderful and amazing. And, you know, crossing the finish line, talking to the people who are there, or even if I don't do the race, sometimes I'll just volunteer. And that is every bit as amazing. Just watching other people in physical extremes and seeing how they react to it. And I don't know, just I could go on and on about all the cool experiences I've had watching people do amazing things and helping other people along the way. My husband did the St. George half Ironman now. It was the national championships. And one of the most amazing things was we sat at this aid station that was at the end of the bike and also the start of the run. And, you know, hours and hours after the race leaders had gone past, the professionals, and, you know, even after the good amateurs had gone past, there were these people who were severely overweight, 100, 200 pounds overweight, dressed in that spandex stuff that you see, you know, mm-hmm. triathletes wearing and riding these bikes. And I just watched them and thought, the kind of courage that it takes to get on your bike and put on that spandex when you know you don't look great.
Yeah, you look at the other people and
but
go,
but you are trying to make your life better. I mean, I just was in awe of the courage and strength that it took for those people to be the last one in the race. You know, to know that you're going to be the last one in the race and people are going to be watching you. But to just do it anyway because it was going to help you be, you know, closer to the person that you wanted to become. You know that these people set goals and they want to stretch themselves. And I was just, I'm so impressed with the people who are doing that.
Does the book Iron Mom kind of read like how you've been talking about it, where it's like, here's a lesson and then you kind of share stories and expound upon it, or like?
It is partly a memoir and partly a how-to manual. So each chapter has me talk about a certain experience that I had in Ironman competition or some other triathlon competition. And then it has tip sections on how to get fit, how to think the right way about getting fit, sometimes how to buy the right equipment. There's a section on swim stroke. I don't mean to be a super expert. I don't think of myself as an expert, even though I've been doing this for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But I'm experienced. Mm-hmm. So my tips are from somebody who's an experienced triathlete at this point. I have a section on eating and what I think is healthy food and what I think your focus should be and not focusing on, for example, weight, which I think is terrible, terrible way to gauge whether you've gotten healthier. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who said that she tried running for 6 months and she only lost 4 pounds and so she gave it up. And I was just like, what?
Yeah.
Losing weight is, like, a lot of the time you will actually gain muscle for a while when you're not losing weight. And if you either don't have a scale that measures your body composition changes, or if you're not measuring something like just your waist circumference will tell you whether you're getting fitter or whether you can run further. You know, there's, I list
or
the different measures.
Or how did you feel? That's, I mean, that's the biggest thing for me is it's like, I can tell if I haven't worked out for a while because it's like, man, I have no energy to do this. I mean, even just those simple things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how you feel is ultimately the main reason why I think that we should have a healthy lifestyle is mm-hmm. so that we can live more richly. Not, I mean, becoming an athlete is not something everybody's going to do, but I do hope that the book inspires people everywhere to do a small thing different in their lives, and mainly to do that small thing so that they are better. You know, you are a better person if you're able to do more, if you're eating healthier and you're exercising more. I do believe that that's part of the reason I'm able to do so much in my life is because I'm fit. And having a fit body helps me have a fit mind. It helps me get more done.
What do you have a calling right now in your ward?
I am in the nursery. I love the nursery.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's sort of ironic.
Yeah.
Now, 6 years later, after I lost my daughter, I'm back in the nursery. And I mean, there was a long time period when I wondered if I would have another baby. Ultimately, I didn't have one. But I so love little kids. And yeah, the lesson, Jesus loves you, is pretty much the lesson every week.
Which is awesome.
You show them a picture, show these little nursery kids a picture. Who's this a picture of? Jesus. That's what they know. They know what Jesus, that every picture is Jesus, and they know Jesus loves him. And I love singing songs with them. And I don't know. I also think it's fascinating to watch little children and try to figure out the world. I remember I was watching these two little boys. They were trying to play with this car that had two spirals, and at the top you put the cars at the top and then you push this button and the cars would start down the spiral. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the little boys had his hand blocking one of the cars, the other little boy's car, from going down the spiral. And so the little boy whose car it was really frustrated, but he didn't understand that the boy was blocking it, so he just kept pressing the button. He kept pressing it over and over and over again. And I just thought, oh, I love how you get to see how small human brains work by working in the nursery and looking at how the kids play with toys, because they don't understand a lot of the workings of the universe. But for that kid, pushing the button made the car go. And so he just kept trying the same thing over and over again. Anyway, yeah, I like the nursery a lot.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, what would you pick? It can be something that exists or something that you created.
I don't know. I love the nursery. If there were a second calling, calling number two, I would probably pick something like ward playwright. I would love to write. Oh boy, now if my stake president's listening to this, I can expect to get a
road
call.
Show.
But road show, I don't know if that's the right term, but yeah, maybe.
I can go playwright.
Yeah.
Okay, so ward playwright. Let me ask you this then. What is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith. I don't know. I guess I would say it's what I was talking about before, just the resilience of God, and that, you know, no matter how many times you mess up or how mad you get or how horrible you are, God always loves you. Just there's nothing that you can do that's so terrible that God doesn't love you anymore. I mean, I think small children are often testing with their parents to see if the parents will love them if they do this, or if they do this, if they do this. I mean, I think that we are still like that as adults with God, mm-hmm. that we are still sort of testing him to see, can you still love me if I'm like, in a way we are continually revealing ourselves to ourselves and mm-hmm. to other people as well, like getting past our pretenses that we're perfect, or even past the pretense that we're pretty good, and then down into the deeper part of ourselves where we realize, you know, that thing that I thought was so good about myself. For me, when I was in high school, I thought that my hyper-focus and my list-making was what made me better than other people. Mm-hmm. And I've realized now as I'm older that that's really an OCD behavior that I adopted very early on to deal with my anxiety that I wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. And it masked for a long time the fact that I had this anxiety, because I was so successful at my list making and accomplishing that I got a lot of feedback from people that I was good enough. Mm-hmm. But that kind of feedback isn't really going to fix the deeper worry that you're not good enough. I think ultimately I sort of peeled that away and realized I still had that fear of not being good enough. And until you're willing to admit that to God and to other people, I think you're always going to be afraid. So... Mm-hmm.
The name of the book is Iron Mom. It's Mehdi Harrison. You can find it. Where can people pick it up?
Probably Amazon is the best place to get it, or you can go to Strider's in Layton. It's a running store. They're carrying it right now.
Oh, cool. And if you just go online and search Mette Harrison, M-E-T-T-E.
Yes.
That's how you can find not only Iron Mom, but all those other titles and future titles as she continues to write. Yes. We hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen to it this week, that you will be healthy enough to listen to it next week. And in the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back.